kwakuwamkwamnyako nauvuku na undukufu hata milele.
Broadcasting from high above the reserve, this is Radio Harambe. Jambo, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Radio Harambe, brought to you by JamboEveryone.com. I am Dave McBride, broadcasting from the Radio Harambe studios at an altitude of 1,998 feet above the savannah, and joining me from somewhere in the world, a man who, as we speak, is blue-skying concepts for his own barge in the New Rivers of Light water show, it's Safari Mike. Mike, how are you, and where are you calling us from?
It's funny that you mentioned the term blue. I'm actually in the Zuzi National Nature Reserves.
Okay.
You know what that has to do with blue?
I don't know what Zuzi is.
I'm in China. I'm in the Qinling Mountains of central China, and we're studying the golden snub-nosed monkey who have very, very blue faces.
Really?
Yes. They're very. They have a lot of fur. They live in the mountains where it gets cold. They're up there with red pandas and the like. And they're highly endangered. There's only about 20,000 left in the world. Pretty much all of them live in China, and this is another animal that China will sell to zoos across the world, although not nearly for the steep price of $1 million that they charge pandas. This is more in the name around $100,000, but they're very rare in zoos, and they're endangered.
Very cool. And also joining us today for the show is the host of the Modern Mouse Radio podcast and a great friend of ours. It's Josh Taylor. Josh, before I introduce you here really fully, we plugged your show just there, Modern Mouse Radio, but I want you to plug something else because I hear there is some Animal Kingdom related things that you need to plug, and we got to get that in right away.
Yeah, I'm actually in charge of the new Pandora. I will be running the project from here on out. No, actually, ModernMouseRadio.com is not just about a podcast. It's we do all kinds of stuff, videos, blogs, and whatnot. And Angie and I kind of sat down. She's an amazing artist. She's been doing some of the T-shirts for our website and some other illustrations. And we sat down and thought about, you know, what would be something really cool that nobody's doing in the Disney realm that we could make a run for. And we thought, she's a great illustrator. Together we could come up with some stories. And so we're putting out a weekly comic strip starting this week, so by the time that this podcast goes out, the first one will already be up.
Cool.
So Modern Mouse Radio is going to be doing this comic strip, and we actually decided what would be a great way to do a Disney comic strip. And there's so many great stories with the Animal Kingdom. Joe Rohde and company definitely worked out a lot of details and a lot of story that go into those lands. And we found comedy in Dinoland USA and in Chester and Hester's Dinorama, and what those two people might be like, and kind of giving an explanation to these people. Obviously, the story that they give us through Disney is somewhat vague. You know, they're an elderly couple that live in this town that has basically become a dinosaur haven and a tourist attraction. And so the idea is, how do these two people who own this plot of land take advantage of the tourists in town? And so that's kind of where we started. Was, how do these two people take advantage of the tourists, and who are they really? Who is this old married couple, and what are they like? And so that's kind of where our story takes off, and hopefully as the strip continues, you get to know who Chester and Hester are, and we'll get to know a little bit more about their wheeling and dealing.
Well, that's right in Mike's wheelhouse.
I know, this is a terrific idea. I love it. It's very original. I really like it. Is it going to be like a comic strip, like in a newspaper kind of thing, like four or five panels or whatnot?
Right. So we're not doing a full fledged book. We're doing four or five panels, something that's going to be quick and easy to read that we can throw up on the site once a week. It's really, there's so much going on the site that we don't have a lot of time to do like a full fledged comic every week or even a monthly comic, but to do three to five panels and kind of get out a few quick jokes is really where we wanted to go initially, and I think that's what we're going to stick to.
Very cool. Well, in today's show, we are going to discuss the news from Disney's Animal Kingdom and Walt Disney World. Then in our feature segment, the reason why we brought Josh on, we are going to have our first ever opening of the Lost Animal Kingdom files as we take a look at the biggest file in the cabinet, really, the Beastly Kingdom. But let's start off with the local news. First, about a week ago or so, Disney announced their this year's calendar of special animal events. I'll give you just a handful of them just so you understand what I'm saying. On May 20th is World Turtle Day. May 6th, they do International Migratory Bird Day. And then there's the cool ones kind of in the summer, which it's a coincidence, right? July 29th, Big Cat Day. Oddly enough, there's nothing scheduled for the fall or winter, Mike, which makes me believe it's just an incomplete list because, for one thing, they always celebrate Bat Day on Halloween.
Yeah, they've done that for quite a few years, so I'm sure they'll probably do that again. They just haven't announced it.
Yeah, so you could check out the calendar of events for all that, and they had that. It was on the Parks blog. The next one we have, speaking of the Parks blog, is for the first time in a long time, really, this week's Wildlife Wednesday posting, which is sort of a series of postings they do on the Parks blog, the Disney Parks blog. They actually put out some timely news. And it's hard to really tell from the pictures. They put up a lot of cool pictures of the white-cheeked gibbons that you find in Asia. And it appears, Mike, we'll let you speak on this again, that they have some new digs.
Yeah, they just it just changed around the exhibit a little bit. They added the structure, an additional structure for them to climb on, which is apparently closer to, you know, the viewing area. So you have a better chance of seeing them a little bit closer than you did before. Nothing major, just a little tweak to the exhibit.
I thought it was kind of cool they put that on the Parks blog.
Yeah.
I don't know, Josh. The Parks blog does tend to be a little bit
dry?
Useless?
I like the Wildlife Wednesdays. I like bringing the ideal of conservation and keeping up with the park, but not only keeping up with the park, keeping up with the conservation efforts, kind of giving that little plot on Wednesday. I do like that a lot. You're right in the sense that the Parks blog serves two purposes in my eyes. It gives a lot of preview pictures and videos for things that are coming. But then at the same time, it toots the horn of everybody else that's there.
Right.
It continues to, not really for the parks, but actually for the bloggers, you know, and they take pictures of, like, useless things. It's like, oh, here's a picture for Photo Friday. And it's like, hey, cool, we're all taking pictures for Photo Friday. Like, you're the Disney Parks blog. You should be telling us, like, all this exciting info or you know, giving us something more informational. But they tend to not.
Well, and Mike has I don't know if you know this, but Mike has a particular chip on his shoulder over the Disney Parks blog. He was, I believe you were censored, correct, Mike?
I just was, yes, pretty much.
Well, we won't go into that too much. The next story is Bradley Falls, which is a snack cart located on the path between Africa and Asia. It had been closed for quite a while, matter of months, and it appears it's reopened. I don't know much about what they're serving there now. They only ever served a couple of things. Mike, we rave about the counter service options at this park quite a bit. Hoping it holds that standard at the very least. The new incarnation.
Yeah, there's a couple of vegetarian items. This used to have, it still has the edamame beans and it still has the Asian noodle salad, but it got rid of falafels and there was something else that was on there. I forget, but now it has a Thai coconut soup. I imagine this is like the winter maybe menu, so it'll probably switch around, you know, depending on the time of the year, you know. So
yeah.
Right now it has a soup for the colder months.
Now let's move on to a story in a website called the OrlandoParkNews.com. They tend to, I don't know if it's every week, but it's quite regularly, they do a sort of posting that is just sort of a download of photos. They throw up just literally dozens of them. And kind of walk around the park, and they sort of focus on the new things and the different things and maybe the construction and stuff like that. They seem to always, every couple of weeks or so, have another picture up there, whereas they try to get the best view they can from the Festival of the Lion King project. From this, because neither Mike nor I have been in the park this in the last couple of weeks, there's a couple of things we can glean from this particular one. And the first one that comes to mind is there are some walls up in front of a few of the animal exhibits that look to me like they were on Discovery Island.
Yeah, it looks like the otter one. That's what I thought it was.
Now, there's no word on what they were doing here, but I think with that Gibbon story in mind, it could kind of be the same thing.
Yeah, well, the otter exhibit is one that's obviously, water-based, so I'm sure there has to be some sort of work done on a periodic basis to the exhibit. Anything that deals with filtered water and flowing water sooner or later needs to be shut down for a little bit to have some work done. This could be just that. I mean, for all I know, the walls could come down in a couple of days. I can't imagine. I know nothing of, changing out animals or really redoing the exhibit. Just a little, tender loving care, really, it looks like.
There also, another thing that we saw in that particular article is... And Mike, I bring this up because I never heard of this, but I guess they're adding interactive elements to the Doug and Russell meet and greet queue, that one that's kind of right there and right off the Tree of Life. The line's not a large space. It's just kind of under a shelter. It's not an indoor exhibit like you have for the Mickey and Minnie one, the Adventures Outpost. Did you know they were putting in interactive elements here, or did anybody know?
I did not know. It's almost like looks like it's a kiosk under like this cloth wrapping that apparently is some sort of interactive something or other. It's a very boring queue. It can get a little busy there. Doug and Russell, they're right there for everybody to see. So kids see them and they want to line up. So it can get kind of, Enchanted Tales with Belle, but it can get a little crowded there. So I guess they're going to add something to, make it a little bit more interesting.
Now, Up is one of Safari Mike's all-time favorite films.
It's the best Pixar movie.
Josh, do you agree or disagree?
I've had this conversation a lot with a lot of people about Pixar, and I don't want to get too far into it.
Okay.
But due to its social aspects, as well as it's great storytelling, as well as it being just a phenomenal movie all around, I have to say WALL-E is actually the best Pixar film.
Wow, nice pick.
Yeah. I think it was the most adult film that they did, but also the most... it was kid-friendly, but it was also the most appealing to... I would say like an Academy Award type of class, that silent film type of thing. Right. The shows of the social aspect. There were a lot of underlying messages on that film, as well as just a great story on top of it. So, anyway, I don't want to get too far into it, but that's my thought.
So that was just a dodge on Up there, Mike. I don't know if you noticed that.
Up is good, but, it's no WALL-E.
Well, since the two of them said their favorites, I will say mine. It's Ratatouille. The next one, again, related to the OrlandoParkNews.com photo, is... pictures of some walls are up in the area between Zawani Traders and the entrance to the Wildlife Express train, the train that takes you out to Rafiki's Planet Watch. This is sort of a random wall that's just kind of sitting there, and a lot of people are talking about how this could be a additional pathway between Africa and Asia. It's going to have to be a bit of a windy path. If you've seen some of the stuff up top there, there's some cast member things going on back there. But that's what we've been hearing, right, Mike?
I've heard that, but I've also, a little birdie told me that, and we talked about this on a previous show,
right?
That what that is a brand new, relatively large counter service eatery that would go from there and basically go all the way to the other side where it would, spill out onto right next to Tamu Tamu on the path that currently goes between Africa and Asia. So it's going to be something, obviously. It's a big wall. It's not
right.
Where they're doing something fairly significant there.
And there's still trees behind the entire wall. So there's no demo going on right now, as we can see. So,
correct. The walls just went up, though.
Yeah, the walls just went up. So we'll keep you posted on that. And my final bit of local news is last week, a YouTube channel called Big Fat Panda animalkingdom.com, I guess you can find it through just that URL, posted a video from the Animal Kingdom, from an Animal Kingdom cast member event. The event was essentially a screening of the film Avatar for cast members, but it also included introductory comments by Josh D'Amaro. He is the top executive for the Animal Kingdom. Joe Rohde, we know who he is, and Avatar producer John Landau. Now, we didn't get much new information here. In fact, we didn't really get any. But what we did get was what I consider Joe Rohde's most impassioned argument for the project yet. So let's just pause here for a second and take a listen to a few minutes of that.
Any good story, by the way, not just Animal Kingdom, any good story is about something. Something is underneath the plot. Something is underneath the character, underneath the setting. And that inner value, the inner idea that a story is about, that's where the strength of that story comes from. That's why you can listen to a story that unfolds over a long period of time, because you can see this pattern of meaning emerging out of the story, that it means something. An Animal Kingdom means certain things. The design of Animal Kingdom is very deliberately and very consciously built around a certain set of ideas. And once you start looking at Animal Kingdom with these ideas in mind, it becomes very clear that it is based on these ideas. The first idea, the first theme of Animal Kingdom is this notion of the intrinsic value of nature, the supreme value of nature, the idea that no other value can be held up against nature and trump it. Nature is going to be a more powerful and more valuable value than anything else you see around it. And that's one of the reasons the park is much more landscape-based than architecture-based. That's the reason when a tree falls over in Animal Kingdom, we might just let it lie there and turn back into soil. That's why the park has this sort of unrehearsed quality, why the buildings look like they're crumbling and succumbing to the forces of nature, because we want that sense of the power and primacy of nature to infuse the entire park. So that's one value system. And it goes down to the tiniest little details. You just start making comparisons. You can ask yourself, would that thing be made of wood? Would that thing be made of stainless steel? And you'll see that these design decisions are down to a very fine gradation. The second value system is this notion of transformation through adventure. The idea that if you go somewhere you've never been before, try something you've never done before, see something you've never seen before, that experience alone makes you a new person. You're transformed. If you go out and seek adventure, adventure itself will change you and you will be transformed. And the park has that adventure motif. We have stories that are unreconciled. We have, you go out on the safari, something new happens every single day, which I love. And so we want, and it's part of the reason why the park has that look. Big chunks of the park have that look that kind of looks like nobody's in charge, like nobody's taking care of it. Because that's adventure too, so that's another theme. And then the third theme is this sense of a personal call to action. Most of the stories that happen at Animal Kingdom are about you. It's about you, it's happening to you. We don't tell a lot of stories that are stories about some beloved or non-beloved third person and what happened to them. Our stories are about you and what's happening to you, and we believe that if you put these three together, you come to a place that is built about the supreme value of nature, in which you undergo a transformation because you set forth on adventure. When you receive a call to action, you will act on behalf of nature, since it is a supreme value. So it is kind of a big construction. Now, tonight you're going to watch Avatar. In a second, I'll turn it over to John to talk more about that. But when you watch this film, I want you to think about these three values as you watch that story unfold. The intrinsic value of nature, the idea that nature is a greater value than any value you can help hold up against it. Transformation through adventure, the idea that if you go out and engage that which you do not know, you will be transformed and made better. And a personal call to action. And I think you'll see that the underlying value of this film sits squarely on top of the values of Animal Kingdom and is not just kind of a nice fit, but actually an extraordinarily smooth and very clear and vivid expression of the underlying value systems of the park.
Okay, that was Joe Fauria, Joe Rohde. Just to recap a bit, Rohde, Mike, here. This is what got me about it. In no uncertain terms, he says that the Avatar project fits perfectly into what he calls, and in quotes, the value system of the animal kingdom. And he defines those values as these three things: the intrinsic value of nature, transformational experience through adventure, and a personal call to action. Now, let me throw this open to the both of you. Is this Joe Rohde telling you what his three values were when he built the park? Or is this Joe Rohde telling us what his three values are now that help him to explain why Avatar is being put in here?
You know, I am a big supporter of Joe Rohde. I think that he is, out of anybody that's working down in Disney World, not obviously he worked on Aulani and is working with several other parks, I think that he sticks true to that. You can see the work in Aulani, you know, several years now after Disney's Animal Kingdom. Aulani definitely speaks volumes to Hawaii, and it's true to form and what Hawaii is, because he grew up there and lived there. I think that he is a very interesting guy, and I think he definitely sticks to his guns. The important piece for me here was actually from John Landau, where he said, you know, we're not taking you into Avatar. That's not the point of this. The point of this is taking you to Pandora and opening up this world. So forget about the movie. Let's just basically focus on this, and like this alien planet, which is interesting to me that the person producing Avatar said this isn't about the movie. I hope to believe him. I hope he's, you know, telling it from the heart. But I agree with Joe Rohde, and I think that this was a good coming out party for cast members of Animal Kingdom.
Mike, before you go into the values thing here, I just want to piggyback on that for a second. I do agree. That's a great catch, Josh. That was a very important piece of information, really, from John Landau. And also, to kind of to go with that, at the very beginning, which was not in the clip you just heard, Joe Rohde talks about how there's a real technological challenge they're facing in being able to do that. So that's obviously the focus. But Mike, your thoughts?
My thoughts were, just going to what Josh said, I mean, that's the important aspect of this, I think. They can't talk about, I mean, it can't be about the movie, just because, first of all, nobody cares about the movie.
Oh, come on.
Second of all, I mean, it's about, you know, the army destroying, and I mean, they got to stay away from the movie itself and focus on the environment, which is what he was saying, which what, you know, Josh had pointed out. I mean, that's the important aspect. If they could focus on that and bring like a Cars Land type of area to Animal Kingdom that just immerses you into this alien planet, that might be interesting. I think that could be a hit. I don't think, you know, a boat ride telling you the story of Avatar 1 and Avatar 2 would be well received at all. So I think that is important.
I guess I agree. You know, I'm not a big fan of the let's retell the story of a movie in an 11-minute boat ride under any circumstances. That's never my favorite rides. I always think that they kind of reach a little bit on those, and I'm not a big fan of that. I don't even like it when they do it in a bit longer format, like at Finding Nemo. I just think that kind of the story kind of dies a little bit when you're not able to tell the nuances and really develop the characters. But if there really are true technological challenges facing them, then it does look like these sort of concept things that we've been seeing are coming to life here. And it does sort of explain why it's taken so long, you know?
Joe Rohde does say in that, you know, he loves the idea of building this. It's not about the concept artwork or, you know, all the fancy schmancy photos that they put up on the Disney Parks blog, like those even matter. But it's really about like getting your hands dirty, getting in there and building this from the ground up and really trying to make a good go at it is most important to him, which gives me the idea that he's not letting up on the idea that he wants to tell a story here. It's not the Avatar story, but it's a story nonetheless, maybe about this planet, about saving it, you know, and that's part of the Avatar film, but you know, it's an underlying thing. But I think that he's getting at wanting to really build this to tell the story that he wants to tell, and the pictures don't portray that, you know, the press announcements don't portray that. Getting to build it and seeing those things starting to come to life and starting to see where this place is going to be going, I think that's what he's most excited about.
I would agree entirely with that, and it does seem like it does seem as though to me that you can extrapolate from that that the same kind of values can then be seen in some of the new things that we're seeing otherwise as well. I'm speaking specifically of the Rivers of Light, which I'm hoping is sort of a personal call to action rather than just pictures of Mickey Mouse going down the river there. That's neither here nor there. My final story is just a little bit about JomboEveryone.com. As I've said a few times in the blog, 2014 is going to be a busy year for us. We have a lot of things in the works, but one thing you can see in progress, kind of as we speak, is we're remaking the website quite a bit for a lot of reasons. One, to offer some more options, but also to make it less expensive for us because we want to really focus the money that we make onto our conservation efforts. But with that in mind, we have two new blogs that you can now follow. Photo Safari and good old Safari Mike has his brand new blog as well. You can find Mike at safarimike.blogspot.com. And you can find our photos at disneyphotosafari.blogspot.com. For the time being, most of what you're going to see on those things are going to be kind of older things that we're migrating into the new page. Certainly gives our new readers a chance to follow up or to catch up on things. But we are working to offer as many different things to read in the course of a day as we possibly have time to post. And with that, we're going to take a short break, come back with the world news on Radio Harambe in just a second. Jennifer Green of Destinations in Florida is the official travel partner of Radio Harambe and JomboEveryone.com. Jen can do everything you need done in order to book your next Walt Disney World vacation and have the time of your life. She is an expert in everything Disney and will remove all the stress of booking your trip. And she is as committed to conservation as we are. So every vacation you book, or even every quote you request, means Jen and Destinations in Florida will make a donation to the Jombo Everyone conservation effort. You can contact Jen directly by emailing her at jennifer.g@destinationsinflorida.com or by calling her directly at 443-424-0181. You can also head over to JomboEveryone.com and click the Destinations in Florida icon to get your vacation started. Seriously, what can be better than booking a Disney World vacation while helping to save wildlife? Welcome back to the Radio Harambe podcast. Dave McBride, Safari Mike's with us as well, and so is Josh, the host of Modern Mouse Radio. But before we talk to him a little bit more, we're going to send it over to Mike for the world news. Mike, what do we got this week? It's a slow week, right?
Yeah, kind of slow. I'll start off with Snow White's Mine Coaster over in the Magic Kingdom. They've been adding a lot of trees and greenery, and now there's actually a working waterfall coming off the mountain. So I think we're sort of getting close to this thing actually being ready. They have not announced a specific date, or even, any kind of opening date for this. But I would assume it's probably more in the neighborhood of, early summer as opposed to before the holiday season.
Well, this is the one, this attraction in particular, Josh, you probably chime in on this. I have never gotten so much information on the building of an attraction from Disney ever compared to this.
Yeah, over the last, I'd say since the first D23 Expo, they've been really all about using social media as well as their YouTube page and the Stupid Parks blog, like we were saying, to give us as much information as possible. I mean, we've basically virtually ridden this ride like 7 times.
Right.
They've given us that many videos. like the video they posted, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, by the time this probably gets out, about how they painted the cars. it's a great little video, sure, but did it really need to be made? I don't think so.
I mean, they put a portage on in the construction site and it gets tweeted.
Right. And maybe that's just them trying to keep ahead of all of the other quote-unquote Disney news sites, you know, trying to one-up them before they can get to the story. But to be honest, a lot of people talk about this from all the different sites and podcasts. It seems like, you know, they built Disneyland in a year. And it's taken them, gosh, how long to finish New Fantasyland? Four or five years now?
Yeah.
I like the fact that they're putting so much work and effort into it, and it does look beautiful. But, you know, to update us on every little thing, they probably could have been working on a little bit faster.
Probably true.
Right.
Are you excited about this ride?
I'm excited about this ride. I'm excited about the possibilities of the technology here. You know, if you're familiar with Disneyland Paris, you know, kind of the crush coaster and how it can slow down and speed up at certain times. And of course that goes along with the EMV, vehicles that are along with Dinosaur over Animal Kingdom. That kind of technology and pushing that forward, I like that idea, considering especially that right now with, Harry Potter being extended over at Universal Studios, I think they really need to up their game, because I think Universal is technologically pushing their boundaries, I think, a little bit faster than Disney has.
Yeah, I would agree.
Mike? Sadly.
What's next, Mike?
Sure. Let's go to DVC, which I am a member of. They have announced some new major discounts for DVC owners for annual passes. You can get the premium annual pass at about $500, which is a fairly significant savings.
But a significant increase from last year.
Correct. Correct. It is more. The Disneyland, there's a Disneyland Resort Deluxe annual pass for about $430. And there's a Disneyland Deluxe. And also the Premier Pass, which gets you to both Walt Disney World and Disneyland, is also discounted. It's about $900. But, you know, they're offering them now between from February 6th to April 30th, you can purchase them, and it has to be activated by January 31st, 2015.
Let me try to be nice. One thing you notice Mike did not say is that there is no longer, as far as I can find, maybe I'm wrong about this, but as far as I can see, there is no longer an annual pass discount for DVC members off a regular annual pass. Last year, they offered a deep discount on the Premier annual pass, the pass that gets you into the water parks and the I'm saying that right, Mike? It's called the Premier annual pass or the
The Premier annual premium. Excuse me, premium.
Okay. Pass.
Which is what I purchased last year.
Right. They gave you a deep discount to the point where that pass cost about as much as the discounted annual pass, the regular annual pass for DVC members. Now, DVC members have always gotten an annual pass discount, at least since they stopped giving away tickets to the parks, which they used to do years and years ago. But they've had annual pass discounts for ages. And then last year, we all said, oh boy, why are they doing this? Why are they offering the premium annual pass? So, and everybody tried to tell me, oh, it's because they want to get up the people in the park and all. Hooey. They did it because what they planned on doing was next year taking away the annual pass discount for regular annual passes and making sure that all DVC members spend $500 a ticket for an annual pass. Now, I don't mind that for people who are local and who can get their money's worth out of it. But most people who own DVC points are going down there for a week and a half, 2 weeks at the most. And they're now paying $500 for a ticket. Now, maybe I'm making a big deal out of this, but boy, was this sly, Mike.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, I don't know what else to add to what you just said. I mean, that's pretty much what they did.
I'll throw my Debbie Downer advice in.
Yeah.
For me, DVC members pay tons of money already just to be a DVC member. On top of that, you know, like you said, they're paying a ton of money just to get the annual pass. For me, the restrictions as far as you can only get it from this date to this date doesn't make sense to me. No. DVC holder, I feel like that should be open year-round. No question about it. You put in all this money to having, like you said, a week or 2 weeks worth of time at any of the resorts. You should be able to buy into whatever, it doesn't matter what it is, at a discounted rate any time of the year.
Josh, I always had that. That was always the case. There was never a time limit on getting your annual pass discount. The whole point of the annual pass was, listen, you're getting 2 weeks worth of hotel rooms. We don't want you using more points to get a week's worth in the expensive place. We want you to get 2 weeks worth in the places that have less amount of points to spend so that you're here longer spending more money, and we'll offer that to you. We'll offer this annual pass discount to you so that you can have that long sort of length of stay pass. And so now what they come out is with this is wonderful announcement, more magic for the Disney Vacation Club members. Once you hear more magic, you know, it's kind of like have a magical day. Some cast members used to tell me when they say have a magical day, they don't really mean have a magical day.
Right.
So when they release this thing about the more magic coming for DVCers, and all of a sudden you look at it and you realize, no. And the time is coming where these points aren't going to be worth it anymore to me. I mean, it really is, because if I have to spend $1,000 just on tickets for 2 weeks, think about it. That's $100 a day.
Right. Yep.
So anyway, Mike, what's the next one? I've ranted enough, I believe.
Well, this is a related story because adding to the magical day for a DVC owner, you can now go into some dinners that they're offering for DVC people only at the very low price of about $150 to $175 per person. It is hosted by wine experts, who they have not named. But anyway, a couple of events. One is a dinner at Flying Fish on February 27th. One is a dinner on March 13th at Citricose, and one is a dinner at Artist Point on March 27th, all of course, of this year. I recommend you go to the Disney Food blog to look at the menus to see if you're at all interested in, but it's a rather steep price, to say the least.
Josh, are you a DVC member?
No, and that's something that I've wanted to do sometime in my lifetime, but with stuff like this happening, it just seems like, what's the point? I'd much rather just buy an annual pass or a premium pass or whatever and go as I please instead of being a DVC member, which seems like I'm paying way more money than I would never need to, especially only to get 2 weeks worth out of the year.
Right.
Yeah, so
I mean, I used to say to people all the time, if you want to go there, it really is a great deal. It's starting to be less of one.
Yeah.
You know?
It's certainly no deal to buy it directly from Disney. It's absolutely no. I mean, there is no reason anymore. But resale. I mean, that's what I did. I bought mine on resale.
Yeah.
At a relatively inexpensive price.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's becoming less and less worth it.
And I bought mine on from Disney 10 years ago for the price that people are paying on resale now. So, yeah, it has really exploded on people.
Yeah, yeah.
Anything else, Mike? We got time for one more, or are we all set?
One more. Coming to Disney Springs, we've uncovered a construction permit that shows, somewhere between Paradiso 37 and Raglan Road, they're building the Boathouse Orlando, which is a Stephen, I guess you pronounce this, Schuschler restaurant, or Sushler, or whatever his name is. He's the one that is involved with T-Rex and Rainforest Cafe and Yak and Yeti. It obviously will be in the Landing District of Disney Springs, and it's expected to open by the end of 2014. It'll be one of the first things to open in the new Disney Springs. And it'll also bring with him, and he's been spotted apparently, Mr. Sushler, buying amphibie cars, which if you look at some of the concept art of Disney Springs, you will see it almost looks like these old 1950s, convertible Corvettes and stuff, or whatever they are, Thunderbirds and the like, driving in the water. They're almost like, they look like cars, but they're actually boats. And that's apparently coming in, not in the not too distant future.
Okay.
I know Josh is a big fan of the Disney Springs name, so.
You know, I've said countless times on our podcast that Disney Springs to me sounds like a retirement community.
Yep.
But I like our idea. I like using the lake a little bit more. Obviously, there's nothing that happens out on that lake. So beyond the boats coming in and out from Port Orleans and a couple of the other resorts down that river. But I like using the lake in this aspect as far as the boat restaurant. As long as it's not like T-Rex or Rainforest Cafe, I'm all for that. I a lot of us are over the Rainforest Cafe trend. You know, we don't need a gorilla yelling at us to eat our potatoes or whatever every 10 minutes. I don't know. I still am skeptical about Disney Springs. I don't have anything to say good or bad about it because really we haven't seen a whole lot about it. We do know what the paint color is going to be, though, on the vehicles over at New Fantasyland.
I will tell you one thing, though. The Boathouse is a seafood and steak place.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for putting in like new things that you know that are unique. I'm all for that. But when they tell me that they're going to bring in something that comes off the shelf from a hotel in Vegas, you know, it's not really. I don't get excited about it. You know, I don't need another Planet Hollywood, or like he was saying, I don't need another Rainforest Cafe. It's just not, you know, so I get excited when they're doing something different, you know. But Josh, to Josh's point, Disney Springs at best sounds like a golf course.
That too. And Keith and I over at Wedway, or not at Wedway, oh my gosh. we've actually now taken over Wedway Radio. In Mad Parish, we've kicked them out. We're actually in charge of Wedway as well. I'm also still in charge of Pandora. But us over at Modern Mouse Radio, Keith and I have extensively talked about this off air and on air, that Disney Quest is something that is unique and really cool to Downtown Disney, and they do nothing with it. What it opened as when it opened is pretty much still the exact same thing that it is. If they upgraded that, made it bigger, did something with it, it would bring, I think, a lot more people than a boat restaurant.
I agree 100%. And I guess that's it, right, Mike? We done with the world news there?
That'd be it.
Okay, we're going to take another short break. And when we come back, we're going to open the Lost Animal Kingdom files. Coming back in just a second.
I'm Explorer Mickey, and like most kids, I love zebras. And some of the coolest are the Grevy Zebra. But if things don't change soon, there won't be any left in the wild. The Grevy Zebra Trust is doing everything they can to help keep them from extinction. But there are only a couple of thousand left, so we have to work fast. Go to their website, GrevyZebraTrust.org, and donate anything you can. Even a small donation will help keep the Grevy Zebra alive for us kids and the future generations to enjoy.
And we are back on Radio Harambe. And today, folks, we take our first trip to a secret location, a file cabinet somewhere labeled The Lost Disney's Animal Kingdom Files. And in this cabinet, we find all the attractions and ideas that might have been, but alas, never were. And in our first edition of The Lost DAK Files, we will talk about the biggest file of them all, one that really has its own drawer. The Beastly Kingdom. From the very early stages of development, Disney's Animal Kingdom was going to tell the story of three very different types of animals. The wild animals we see in the modern world, the extinct animals who are no longer here, and the mythical animals that have existed always in our imaginations. Throughout the park, we see real animals, and in Dinoland USA, we see the extinct ones. But for one reason or another, the mythical ones have never made it to Disney's Animal Kingdom. It was a land to be called the Beastly Kingdom. It is why we see dragons on the logo and up on the ticket booths at the front of the gate. But somewhere along the line, the budget got cut, the idea shelved, and the files moved into the Lost DAK file, never to see the light of day again. Almost 16 years later, I think it can be safely said that Animal Kingdom fans are still wishing for the day when the Beastly Kingdom may yet become a reality. And at the end of this segment, my guess is many of you listeners will also feel the same way. So let us start with you, Safari Mike, as you and Josh are both sort of scholars of the Beastly Kingdom. So let us begin with you. And what I want you to do is give us a basic idea of the concept behind what the Beastly Kingdom was supposed to be, other than, the obvious, which was a land, which, you know, has never happened.
Well, first of all, it was a land that has never happened.
Excellent.
basically, it was the land, as you said, of mythical animals. And the design of it, as you crossed over the bridge into this land, in, you know, I've seen some concept where you would actually have a troll underneath that bridge and sort of like a Billy Goat Gruff bridge, which would have been kind of cool. But anyway, and basically you were divided, the land was divided into the light version, like the good side, and the dark version, which was, you know, all the bad critters. And, you know, just to cut right to the chase, the main attraction of this area and the sort of the weenie, as they would say, or the real e-ticket draw was in the dark side. And that was the Dragon Tower, which I'll, you know, hand it over to Josh to talk about.
So the Dragon Tower got kind of a great background in the sense that it was going to be a roller coaster, similar to Rock and Roller Coaster, except for you were going to be basically within this castle. There would be a sleeping dragon, and you would go by the dragon, similar to what Expedition Everest is, which in the sense that you go right by the Yeti there, and it's supposed to swipe at you. It doesn't anymore, but the dragon was supposed to kind of growl at you, and there was supposed to be some kind of fire effect. This attraction, actually, when Beastly Kingdom did not become a land, Animal Kingdom ended up getting moved over to Universal Studios, and some of the people working on that ended up basically really building that attraction or something similar to it in what is now the Wizarding World of Harry Potter in the... it's not Dueling Dragons anymore, but whatever it's called, you know, that attraction there. So, unfortunately, we lost that attraction to Universal Studios, but it was supposed to be a great indoor roller coaster. They would actually shoot you out as well outdoors, but you would basically be chased by this dragon, whether it be animatronic or just a still or whatever, there'd be a fire effect and whatnot. Kind of a cool idea.
I really liked the flying bat kind of concept where you would in the queue you would run across these gigantic, you know, intelligent bats that were trying to, you know, steal the gold from the dragon, and actually the car itself was the melted cauldron being pulled by the dragon. So my memory serves me, the concept for the coaster itself was to be a, what do they call it, inverted coaster, where you would actually, the track would be above you.
Right.
And you would be flying in this cauldron. It just sounded like such a cool concept that it's unfortunate that it never happened.
Well, in the queue, like you said, having a story and kind of leading up to that with the bats, the queue could have been very interactive, and I think that would have been a lot of fun as well, just getting into line and then going through the whole experience. A lost concept, unfortunately.
Josh, before we move on to the next attraction that we would have been in the Beastly Kingdom, I want to just piggyback on something that you mentioned within that introduction there of this particular ride, which was that the concept was lost to Universal Studios.
Right.
Let's not gloss over that, because I think a lot of people feel that what happened there is the reason why Beastly Kingdom was never brought back to life.
Yeah, however, I think that there was still something that could have been done there. The Dragon Tower, being the e-ticket ride, didn't have to happen. They could have definitely done something else. But I guess if they want to say that that's the reason, I think that's a cop-out reason.
Well, I don't think that, I mean, certainly Disney has never said that, but it's one of those things that people always sort of throw out there, right, Mike, about how, well, it was never going to happen once this exodus of talent left for Universal.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's really because, you know, all of a sudden Universal had a Dragon Coaster and we can't be seen as, like, copy Universal. You hear that Disney was worried that because all their people left and went over to Universal and they built the Dragon Coaster over there, the idea would be, even though Disney was the first one to actually design it, no matter what they said to the public and as a large would say, well, you know, they had a, you know, the Dragon Coaster was first at Universal. I just think it's really just money. I mean, they just ran out of dough and, you know, they just never got back to the drawing board. I think that's pure and simple. That was what it was.
I would agree with that, but we do have to remember that this was a time when Michael Eisner was the CEO, and he was the person who tried to pretend that he had the idea for the studio park first.
Right.
So you never know. Well, what was it? What was the next stop along the Beastly Kingdom trail here?
All right. Well, we'll go over to the light side, and we will talk about the Unicorn Maze, which would have been a fascinating, I think, concept, because unlike many of the other major attractions in Disney World, this was a walkthrough. It was actually a maze where you would go through, you know, different sections. There would be four sections, and each one would have basically a mythical animal that was sort of the main character of it. The first one was a sphinx, and you would enter it in all the plants, and there would be these series of gargoyles throughout the maze that would give you hints or tease you, squirt water, that kind of stuff. And, you know, the first section was, as I said, the sphinx. The second section was the lair of the phoenix, and the colors there would have been more, while, you know, the sphinx would have been more Egyptian looking, more Egyptian decor, the phoenix would have been more, you know, orange and yellow colors, like fire. The third one would have been the section of the griffin, which, you know, is a half eagle, half lion, mythical creature. And then the final one would have actually been inside this cave, where you would have come across the unicorn, the main character here. And this would have been an audio animatronic unicorn in this little cavern with all these jewels and all these colors and this pool. And the unicorn would talk to you. And one of the interesting things that they had decided early on was that the unicorn's mouth would not move. They did not want a Mr. Ed kind of moment. They wanted, so it would talk to you telepathically. And it would just tell you some sort of conservation message. It was a fascinating idea for an exhibit. And it also would have been very, you know, it would have also been almost a botanical garden in its own. And you would have been able, before meeting the unicorn, kind of looking out over the maze itself and see all the flowers and all the plants and all the trees. And it would have been a great, it was a great idea that obviously never really took hold.
And that was something too, that they have the Alice in Wonderland maze at Disneyland Paris, and it is successful enough. I think that this would have been something where you could meet these creatures as well as go through this maze. And I think that it would have been maybe something that Disney's Animal Kingdom needs. I mean, they eventually kind of brought on the Wilderness Explorers thing, which is great. But I think before that, they needed something like this, where it was just kind of, not to, you know, sound bad, but kind of a time waster, something where this could really become a full day park because you could spend an hour getting lost in this maze.
Right. I think part of the problem with this attraction in the end was, I imagine the maintenance on this would have been very, very steep. I mean, you're talking about living things that were making the bulk of it. It'd be a lot of you know, I think a lot of money's being spent to make sure the maze was kept up properly. I think that could have been a real issue.
Yeah, you know, you say that though, Mike, but I agree with that, but the botanical gardens aspect kind of brought it home to me when I'll get to what I feel about the concept of Beastly Kingdom later, but when you use the phrase botanical gardens, that really kind of made me say, well, maybe that really would belong in a zoo. You know, that's that kind of brings the natural world sort of into this concept a little bit more so.
I think so too. I've said this in other places. I think there should be a botanical garden somewhere at the Animal Kingdom. I mean, it sort of is spread throughout. I mean, there are, you know, obviously it's a living, you know, living trees all over the place, and some of them are, you know, there's little signs for what they are, but especially over in Dinoland. There's the Cretaceous Trail that has, you know, living ferns and things like that. But a nice botanical garden, like, let's say, in Rafiki's Planet Watch, I think would be a nice place to just visit for a little bit.
And listeners, if you didn't know, if you see a plant that you want to know what it is, you can actually ask somebody. They'll give you a card. The card says something like, what plant is that? You mail it in, and then they tell you, they send it back to you and tell you what it was. It's only at the Animal Kingdom they do that.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. You just got to ask a cast member. They have these little cards in their pockets. At least some of them do.
Or I just said at my house, too. I only have one plant. it might live to see another month, but if you come by within the next month, I will give you a card and let you know what it is.
Okay. Well, when we're done with the unicorn maze, Josh, where do we go next?
Part of the good side as well is the Fantasia Gardens, which will be a boat ride, kind of similar to It's a Small World. You know, that slow moving boat vehicle that could go on a track, and it would take you through some scenes from Fantasia, which beyond Fantasmic and the Mickey Sorcerer doesn't really have a place anywhere in any of the parks, but it does have some mythological creatures. It would take you through the Dance of the Hours scenes, which are the hippos and the crocodiles dancing. And then it would also take you through the Beethoven scene, which has the centaurs and the fauns, the Pegasus, a lot of the Greek mythology going there. So I would assume that this is similar now to, not to go back to Pandora, but what they're trying to do with the boat ride in Pandora. This is kind of the replacement of the Fantasia Gardens. So this was a boat ride that was conceptualized a long time ago. Now it's coming to fruition in a different way. But I would assume you would hear a lot of the music from Fantasia as well. So adding a classical music theme overlay to a boat ride about Greek mythology and some of the other fantastic animals that you see in Fantasia.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the interesting concepts over, like, I like the swan boats. You had actually been in a swan boat. You know, the idea of a Fantasia boat ride dates back. I know there was some concept art for doing it in Disneyland back in the 60s. So it was not an original idea for Disney's Animal Kingdom, but it was one that they sort of rehashed, which, you know, Disney often does. But it would have been interesting, I think. You know.
Yeah, and I think it's the one concept from the Beastly Kingdom that I think really would have solved the issue of not enough Disney. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, it really was. The idea, when you look at it, really is, you know, something that Disney fanatics would really have gone crazy for. Yeah.
That's true. Go ahead, Josh.
Sorry. Fantasia in general, I think, was one of Walt's personal projects that he just loved doing. He got really excited about it when the project kind of came about. And I think the Fantasia, up until his death, still stood at one of his favorite projects that he ever did. And so I think that it would be somewhat appropriate for Disney to, you know, bring back Fantasia in some sort of way. And that was kind of a great nod to Walt Disney there as well. You're right, bringing back the Disney characters as well as something that Walt personally really loved in that boat ride, but unfortunately no fruition there either.
And bringing Fantasia to life in a multidimensional way would have been something that you would see Walt really would have gotten behind and been excited about.
The thing about it, though, the thing about Fantasia, it's, on the one hand, it is such an important movie in the Disney pantheon and in the history of Disney itself and in the history of animation. But on the other hand, there's no real appeal of it to, you know, the princess crowd that you have today. The people who love, you know, Frozen and all that kind of stuff. I mean, they, you know,
tough. They get everything else.
Yeah, but you're not bringing what you said is bringing Disney characters to the park. You're not with this, though.
No, but the Disney historians, the Disney fanatics,
sure,
you know, would really have gone for it.
Right. Sure. How we are somewhat few and far between. You're right. You're right, Mike. This doesn't appeal to the 6-year-old girl that, you know, has been waiting to meet Princess Aurora her whole, you know, young life. But I feel like this has its appeal. If you gave it a chance, if you actually got on the attraction, I think this would be more popular than you might think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I thought it would. I think it probably would have been popular. Yeah. To be fair, it would have been popular, but it's not. But I don't think it would have solved the problem of having Disney characters in this particular theme park.
Well, no, I don't mean Disney characters. I mean giving it that Disney feel. It would have been something that really kind of brought the Disney idea home. Now, we have one more left, right?
Yeah, we do. And this one is not really in Beastly Kingdom, but it kind of sort of is. And it goes back to the old Discovery River boats. And for people who are familiar with the initial days of Disney's Animal Kingdom, there was a boat ride that went around the Discovery River, which circles, of course, the island of the Tree of Life. And back then it was called Safari Village. And basically here, you see some minor remnants of this idea. But basically, what would happen would have been you would have boarded the Discovery River boats and you would have passed a cave that had a dragon in it. And unlike the dragon that you eventually got, which was just a rock shaped like a dragon and it spewed out like some steam and some fire at one point in time, this would actually be a working dragon was the initial idea. Before you even got there, the boat would have passed broken lances and, you know, armor and that was burnt. So you would get this feel that you're, you know, getting close to the dragon's cave. And then you pass the dragon and he would breathe fire on you and you'd get away just in the nick of time. But it wouldn't even stop there. At that point in time, the boat driver would express some sort of, you know, nervousness about maybe the dragon has awoken the Kraken. And then, sure enough, you know, you'd get bubbles all around the boat and you would see a part of the Kraken come rising out of the water. And the boat driver, and this would have been interesting, the boat driver would have actually pulled out some sort of medieval instrument and began playing a tune. I don't know if it would have been a lyre or a harp or whatever, to calm the Kraken, and then would go back down into the water. And then just before you got to your destination, which would have been the dock in Harambe, you would have seen a unicorn along the river. Just look at you briefly before melting back into the trees. Real brief. It would be a real brief encounter with a unicorn. This was the idea behind the initial Discovery River boats, and it was a lot better than what you eventually got, which was basically a boat that went around in a circle and did absolutely nothing.
One day when we open the extinct Animal Kingdom files, we'll discuss that little gem.
Pretty much, yeah, exactly. But this would have been terrific. It would have been very interesting. It kind of would have brought out some of the concepts from the Jaws ride, actually, from Universal, that kind of idea. But, you know, that was the Discovery River boats in its initial stages.
Listen, let me wrap up our Beastly Kingdom look by saying something here that I think I'm probably the only one who feels this way. And then I'll let you two guys kind of wrap it up and talk about it. I assume that I am perhaps the only Animal Kingdom fan who is not emotionally crushed by the fact that the Beastly Kingdom never came to be. I mean, personally, though I like these concepts, I think the natural world, that theme would have been something I would have preferred a larger investment in. Maybe even more investment of time and money and creativity into the world of dinosaurs. Some more sort of real dinosaur stuff. I love these concepts that we talked about tonight, but they sound more to me like, and you guys said this word a couple times, Universal or the Hollywood Studios. It never sounds like Animal Kingdom to me. I'm aware I'm pretty much alone on that. I know a lot of people really like this idea. I do like the idea. I just don't know if it fits any better, if the idea of Beastly Kingdom fits any better into the Animal Kingdom than, say, Avatar or anything else. You know, it's just, to me, I don't pine away for it, but I assume you guys do.
Well, the one thing I would respond to you about that, and then I'll let Josh, you know, respond. The Disney's Animal Kingdom has always been about not, you know, nature and not conservation. Those are elements of it, but it's about man's relationship with nature. And one of the most important aspects of that, in my opinion, is mythology and culture. And this would have been a homage to that aspect of how animals play out in our mythology and our culture and how we, you know, grew as a species ourselves.
Josh?
You know, I'm actually going to give you a surprising answer, Dave, because I am somewhat like you. I don't pine for this. I am disappointed that the park opened without something there. I'm disappointed in the fact that they kind of gave us this Mickey mini camp. You know, to me, that's disappointing, because instead of just closing down that area and eventually opening something else greater over due time, they gave us the Festival of the Lion King, which should have been in Africa to begin with. I'm glad that it is finally moving there. But they gave us this camp that was supposed to be, oh, look, we have Disney characters. I don't know many people that really ever went to Camp Minnie Mickey or spent a lot of time there if they did, otherwise just going to the Festival of the Lion King. I'm somewhat with you in that I don't really pine for it. I think there are better concepts out there. And not to plug Modern Mouse Radio, although I'm going to, so I'm sorry. But Mike was on our show, and we do this armchair imagineering on the show from time to time. And the concept when Mike came on the show was come up with a brand new land for Animal Kingdom. You know, it doesn't matter what it is, as long as it fits within the theme. And I think that between Mike, Keith, and I, we came up with some great concepts that not only outdo what they're putting in with Pandora, but I think outdid what they were going to do with Beastly Kingdom and brought it usually back to the conservation message, which is the focal point of the park, or should be.
Mike, your thoughts on that?
I don't disagree. I mean, the Beastly Kingdom is not the be all end all. I think I like some of the concepts. I you know, some of the ideas behind here, like the Dragon Tower, would have been a lot of fun. Like the Loch Ness, and we didn't even talk about this, but the Loch Ness restaurant where you would eat around basically a lagoon, and every once in a while you would hear faint Scottish bagpipes, and a statue of the or audio animatronic Loch Ness monster would slowly rise out of the water, be like every half hour on the half hour or whatever. You know, things like that would have been fun.
Right.
You know, Mother Goose Shop or whatever some of the other concepts were. Having said that, if they would have built in Australia like I did on Modern Mouse Radio, or you know, Josh's concept of the Amazon or whatever,
right,
or something else, or a redesigned, you know, land about mythical animals, that would have been fine. I'm not a big Avatar guy, as we've discussed a million times. But that having said that, I don't think it had to have been Beastly Kingdom, but I do like the idea of having mythological creatures, you know, scattered throughout the park, i.e. the Yeti.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, go ahead, Josh.
I agree with that. I like the idea of, like you had said previously, you know, there's culture and mythology within all kinds of peoples and all kinds of places. I don't mind that coming to Asia with Expedition Everest. I actually don't mind that coming to World Showcase over in Epcot. I think that's a great idea as well. I think that these ideas and pieces of Beastly Kingdom don't just have to have a whole land. They can fit wherever, not just within Animal Kingdom, but all over Walt Disney World or Disneyland, whatever the parks, even on the cruise ships, doesn't matter. I think that there's a different vibe to what mythology and treating the culture of humanity really with that more than anything, more than animals, can do for Walt Disney World. And I think that we saw that with Expedition Everest, and I think we may see that in the future in other places.
And I also think that a lot of the reason why you hear so much about Beastly Kingdom, and because people pined away about for it so long, was because of the fact that this was an Eisner Park, and Eisner Park's always opened with not enough stuff. And, you know, then 9/11 came not too long after that. The budgets got cut. And this was really the one glaring thing. This was, you know, it was there for us all to see. And as opposed to just being a concept that never got going, this was a concept that everybody really knew about. You know, that everybody was aware this was going to happen, and then it didn't. And that's unusual. A lot of times, you know, we find out about things later on or concepts later on. And some of the things that we found out about that never happened, you know, weren't as big as this. But this would be like saying, you know, we're going to build Expedition Everest and then saying, nah, no, we're not. You know, so I think that kind of had an effect on people too. But before we wrap up, Joshua, I want to make sure you plug away one more time.
I am building Pandora, so you take into consideration. No,
you have work to do.
I do have a lot of work to do. No, check out modernmouseradio.com, the brand new Chester and Hester Animal Kingdom inspired webcomic is up on our site every Thursday. We have tons of blog posts from Angie, Alexia, and myself. Keith puts up videos. We have the Modern Mouse Radio show that goes up every week. And we are actually continuously expanding our site just like you guys are. And right now, I'm actually in the process of switching all of our podcast episodes from one server to the other so that you can enjoy all of our podcast episodes, which has never been done before on our end. It's always been as much memory as we can fit in goes up onto iTunes. Otherwise, you start missing out on episodes. We're changing that, so you're going to go back and be able now to see all of our episodes, one through what we're at now, which is 44. So that's something that's unique and cool to us. And then more stuff is always coming. So do check out modernmouseradio.com. We have posts going up every day.
And you also have like some pretty cool t-shirt things going up there, I saw.
We do have some great t-shirts. Safari Mike is a great model for those if you're interested. but we do have...
That's a phrase I've never heard.
I may never say it again, so enjoy it less. We have some t-shirts, our logo, which Keith designed. He's a great artist, and she is also a great artist, so I'm fortunate to have a couple people on our staff at Modern Mouse Radio to be able to do some of those things. We just put up a Lion King t-shirt, so that appeals to the Animal Kingdom crowd.
Totally, it's real cool too.
And we just put up a Up t-shirt with the grape soda pin. So
one is awesome.
So do enjoy those.
And we can find you on Twitter or anywhere else. Where else can people connect?
You can find me at the Disney Parks blog. you can find me over at twitter.com/modernmouse Josh, or on Instagram at Modern Mouse Josh. And be sure to follow Angie, which is at Angie Carrero, Keith, which is at Keith Lapinig, and Alexia, which is at Alexia DIF agent. She's not only a poster, but she can book your next vacation.
Very cool. Mike, anything else we want to throw in here? I mean, you got your various places people can find you.
Oh, yeah. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Pinterest. I'm on Instagram. Well, whatever. Find me. I'm there.
Go to jomboeveryone.com and you can find all of that stuff. Also, we have a Zazzle store, too, including our great design for Not a Half Day Park t-shirt. If you don't have one of those, you really need one the next time you go in. The only thing I'd say is please subscribe to the show on iTunes, rate us, leave us a review there. Listen to us on Stitcher and Podbean if you're not an iTunes person. Other than that, for Josh and Safari Mike, I'm Dave McBride. Thanks for listening. Quaharini, go well. And we will see you on the next edition of Radio Harambe. Now,